The purpose of a Bible translation should be to convey the meaning of the ancient text as accurately as possible to the reader. We are studying, as I think everybody here knows, a little bit of a unique topic this quarter. We're studying on what we're calling foundations of the Bible. And as we mentioned in the prayer, how do we know that this book that we call the Bible is God's Word? And it's something that we sort of take for granted as we're young and growing up, but at some point we have to question and truly ask ourselves, do I really believe that this is God's Word? And so this class is designed to help us have a greater confidence that what both Stacy and I have promoted through the classes so far, that God's hand intervened and made sure that what we do have today is in fact His Word. Stacy will be Stacy and I are co-teaching the class. He will be walking through with a microphone, and if anybody wants to make a comment of any significance, let's wait until he can get to you with the microphone so that it can be picked up for the people in the room that might not be able to hear, because this is kind of a big room, but also for the people online. So if you have just a one or two word answer, you can call it out. But if you have a comment, let's try to wait for that. So last week we talked about manuscripts, and we established the fact that ideally it would be great to have the very original piece of paper that the Apostle Paul wrote the epistles on, right? But we don't have that, obviously. We talked about reasons why we don't have that, but the fact of the matter is we don't have the original documents that were written that became the Old and the New Testament. But what we have are manuscripts, and these are copies that people made from the originals, and then copies of those copies and copies of those copies. So how many of those manuscripts do we have? Half a dozen or so? No, we've got thousands of manuscripts. And so today what we're going to talk about is how we got to the point of having a what we call a version of the Bible called the King James or the New King James or the New International Version. What are all these versions all about? So if you don't have, there are questions in the back. If you don't have one, raise your hand and Stacy will be grab a copy and get that to you. And these questions are based on some information in a book that Stacy and I are using, and so the questions may, it's one right over here, Stacy. The questions may not make sense to you until we go through some of the information that we talk about. So the way we're kind of carrying out this class is just to sort of go through these questions together. So the first question on the list then is, what is a version? And what's you've heard the term version and you've heard the term translation. And in my mind, it's a little hard to get the difference between the two. And in a sense, there's not a difference. Does anybody want to kind of speculate what the answer to the question, what is a version? All right, so let's talk about what is a translation. What do we mean when we say translation? What language was the Bible written in originally? Hebrew and Greek, the Old Testament in Hebrew, the Greek primarily, the Old Testament in Hebrew, the New Testament primarily in Greek. Some of it was written in a language that's no longer, it's what we call an archaic language, it's no longer used, called Aramaic. Some of the manuscripts that are found were in Aramaic. But it was originally written in Hebrew and Greek. Well, anybody here read Hebrew or Greek? I don't. I'm going to show you some Greek here in a little bit. Oh, there's a hand that went up. So good. We've got some people that can actually read it. I can read the words of Greek. I can pronounce the words. They don't mean anything to me though. So there are people that study these languages and understand them, and they can literally take the Hebrew Bible and just tell you exactly what it's saying. Well, most people, of course, don't have that ability. So we need to translate it into a language that we speak. Now, I know there are people in the room that speak more than one language here. Well, I assume that there is. I don't know for sure that there is. I don't. I speak English. That's it. And some people might question that sometimes, but based on my based on my Alabama roots, you know. But I've tried to improve my my ability to enunciate my words compared to how I spoke when I was a country boy in Alabama. But so I don't speak Hebrew or Greek. I can't read it. So we have to have somebody to translate these documents for us into the languages that we can actually understand. So we have several different English translations today that we'll talk about a little bit later on. So basically, a translation is when somebody takes an original document and translates it into a different language. And then the fact that we have multiple translations, those are the different versions. Why would we have different? I mean, the language says one thing, right? I mean, it's written in Greek and it says this. Should be all like, why would we have different versions? Different words can mean multiple things. That's true in English, exactly. So we will look at that, and you know, we talk about that, and that's exactly right. We'll look at some text a little bit later on if we are able to get to that. But different words and different phrases mean different things. So what I put on this slide here is that the purpose of a Bible translation should be to convey the meaning of the ancient text as accurately as possible to the reader. So if you take a Greek word, there's a translation for that, right? Sometimes there's more than one translation. Some Greek words, just like some English words, have more than one meaning. So the translator has to try to determine what is it that word actually means. But the way that the words are arranged in a sentence sometimes are different in different languages than what we speak. That's true even in Spanish, as I understand. Are there anybody in the room that speaks Spanish? Yes, go ahead, Jack.
I don't speak, but what you're talking about, I empathize with for this reason.
In our experiences in trying to take the Spanish word that we learned and that we use in the Dominican Republic, when we try to take that Spanish into English, there literally are phrases in Spanish that have no exactly English translation. Ergo, this right situation.
Right. And I'll give you just a real simple example. I did take a Greek class way back about 1,000 years ago when I was in college. And one of the things that I remember, and I believe that Spanish is a little bit like this, is that if we're going to talk about a ball that is red, how would we phrase that in English? English. We would say, the red ball. Well, you don't do that in Greek. You say, the ball, the red. I mean, literally, it would you know, have those Greek words that mean the ball, the red. So that would make sense to us in English. So the translators have to obviously arrange the words in the language into which they're translating in a way that makes sense in that language. That might be different from translator to translator. So that's why we get these different versions. But the purpose should be to convey that meaning of what that original writer was meaning as best as they can. Now, the problem that we have is that we don't necessarily know what that original writer was meaning. And you could say that from a standpoint of a biblical, the biblical manuscripts or just any language. If somebody writes something down in one language, do we really know 100% what they were meaning? We talk about emails, for example. We communicate by emails and text these days more than we do by voice. And sometimes it's hard to convey exactly what's being thought in an email. The words come out, are put in one way, the writer has one thought in mind, but the person that reads it might presume, you know, something completely different just because of the way that it's worded. So we have to be very careful about that. And that's obviously the case in the concept of translating documents. So, yes, Bill.
Well, in translation to English, where they have problems is because there's so many words in the English language that means the same thing.
Exactly.
See, and translating in other languages wouldn't be that problem. But in the English language, you know, like, for example, bucket and pail, you know, it means the same thing,
right?
But also pail means skin, you know. So you can see the difference in what they run into when they're trying to translate it into
right
English.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. A lot of words have multiple meanings, and a lot of concepts have multiple words that describe that. Coming in the back.
So to piggyback off of what he just said, it can also be regional. Like, for instance, I'm from up north, so Pepsi is a pop. But down south, Pepsi is a soda. But even in Louisiana, it may be a cold drink.
Yep.
So it could also be regional.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because my grandfather had a unique way of expressing himself. If you think I was country, you ain't seen country. my granddad loved to tell stories. And he would talk about being out in the field and it getting close to noon and time to go, you know, have a bite to eat. And he wouldn't say it was almost noon. He would say it was getting might nigh on up to about 12 o'clock. Anybody ever heard that expression? Might nigh, very close to about here. I mean, I literally would hear him say that. So yeah, you're exactly right. Sometimes we call that colloquialisms, different words that are used within different contexts, different regions of the country. So yes, there's a lot of that that goes on. So how does, second question is, how does a version differ from a manuscript? Remember what a manuscript is? The copies of the original, all of the copies that we have. What languages were the manuscripts written in? The original, whatever the original language was, it was a copy in that same language, either Hebrew or Greek. So we got a lot of manuscripts in either Hebrew or Greek. But then when somebody takes that language and translates it into another language, it becomes a version. So that's how a manuscript and a version are different. Let me cover my other two points here. Here's the thing that we have concern about whenever we read our translations. Sometimes translators' opinions or prejudices can affect the outcome of the translation. Would you agree with that or not? In a perfect world, no. Because it would just say, okay, here's the language, just means this. But we find in a lot of the verses that we look at, there's a little bit of influence there from the reader's or the translator's opinion, or in some case, some pressure from the religious leaders of the time that they might have been working. There are versions that last point there. There are versions that are called versions that, in my opinion, are really just commentaries. They're just the translator expressing what he believes that passage ought to be teaching, rather than what the original writer actually was trying to convey. Yes, in the back.
One of the classic examples of that is when the King James translators were translating in 1611, and they came to the word baptizo, which in Greek means to plunge, to immerse, to dip. Well, King James was the sponsor of that translation. He had not been plunged or dipped or immersed. Mm-hmm. So they took, instead of translating the word, they transliterated it. They took the Greek equivalent for B and A and so forth and made up a new word called baptism in order to escape the possible wrath of the king.
Right. Because by that time, a method of what they call baptism was already to dip or to sprinkle, had already come into play, and so they didn't want to convey the idea that what was originally in the meaning was to plunge in and completely immerse.
I've heard that. Was the King James originally paid for or ordained by the Catholic Church? Oh, wow. Okay.
We'll get to that on this next slide, as a matter of fact. We have what we call kind of a progression of the Bible versions. And we'll answer some of these questions as we go down through this progression. This is even though it looks very, very busy, it's a very simplistic progression of how we go from the original writers to the versions that we have today. So the original texts were written down by how many different authors? Stacy, I forget the number. I'm sorry?
Over 40.
Over 40 different men who wrote the various books of the Bible. And, of course, we don't have any of those copies anymore, any of those originals anymore. We have just some manuscripts that were found. During the period of time between the Testaments, in about 275 years before Christ, the Old Testament was translated into Greek. Anybody have any idea why that occurred? Why would they feel the need to translate the Old Testament into Greek? Exactly. Just like English in our world is the most common, so we need to get the Bible into English. They needed people to be able to read the Old Testament, which was all they had at the time, of course. And so they translated it into Greek. Greek was the prevalent civilization of the time, and so the most common language spoken.
I'm of the opinion that there were very few people who really knew how to read back there in that time. So they relied on the people who translated or wrote down these various books that Paul and others wrote and distributed to them. And when they were distributed, someone in the congregation read it to the others. So that was the way of conveying God's word to the people.
Right. Absolutely true. That concept of only a limited number of people being able to read was true well into the first millennium, the second millennium even, along about, I don't know, what the Renaissance period, maybe it's when more and more people started learning to read. So then we had the Greek Septuagint. So that answers one of our questions. What is the, number four actually, what is the oldest known version of the Bible, version again being a translation, what would the answer to that be? The Greek Septuagint. Again, the Greek Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, so that becomes the oldest version. Third question is, what is a group of documents that is valuable for in determining the text of the Bible? That's the manuscripts that we talked about last week. So we have literally thousands of manuscripts, these copies of the original, and then we began to have versions starting with this translation of the Old Testament into Greek. Well, and then we go for a long period of time, and the manuscripts are copied, and more manuscripts are being created from, I don't know if that date is actually accurate, I just kind of threw that up there, the 100 AD to 1200 AD. Over a long period of time, people were copying the Bible. Again, very limited, you know, they didn't have printing presses, they didn't have computers, obviously. They didn't even have good, you know, pen and paper. They had scrolls. They had animal skins that were formed into parchments that you could make something to write on. They had papyri, which was made from the reed of a plant, which is the predecessor of what we call paper. Did I see a hand back there? No? Okay. So all these manuscripts were being created, and then by about the 300s AD, late 300s, Greek is not the most common language anymore. What has become a more common language than Greek? Latin, because of the influence of what entity? The Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, of course, was prevalent in the Bible times. Obviously, they, even though Greek was the more prevalent, had been the most prevalent civilization, was still the most prevalent language, Rome was taking over at that time. And we won't go into a history lesson on the Roman Empire because I would be way over my head. But the Roman Empire was prevalent. We know about the persecutions of the Christians during the first century and the second century. That was from the Roman Empire. So Latin has become a more dominant language at this time. So somebody said, we need to translate the Bible into our language, and that was Latin. So who did that? Anybody have any idea? You can look at the screen and see. A man named Jerome. Jerome, I got his full name written down. Jerome Stridon was his name. You probably have heard that name. You know, Jerome. He was just an ancient, really smart guy. Ancient philosopher, ancient scholar. And he took it on himself to translate the Bible into Latin so that not everybody could read it, because again, as Ron pointed out, and there weren't that many people who could read, but But there were people who were able to read that. And so for the most part, as Ron said, people would read the Bible in Latin to the people in the audience. Now, what church had become predominant at this time, Bill?
What was his name? Damascus, was it? Pope Damascus, I think, is the one that ordered Jerome to do this because he was the highest scholar at that time, and to translate this.
Okay.
So the Pope was the one.
The Emperor Constantine, over a period of time, you're talking about persecuting Christians and so forth, and the resistance that they continued to get from the Latin community, the leaders of the world at the time, Constantine realized that it's better to catch flies with honey than it is with a fly swatter, so to speak. So he adopted Christianity as the official religion and caused a lot of changes that we are still affected by today.
Right.
I think Constantine is, somewhere in the 600 AD period, is one of the major figures that caused changes that we are still being bothered with today.
Yep. The city that is currently known as Istanbul was at one time known as Constantinople, named for Constantine. And about what was the time frame of that, did you say? I've forgotten. Yep. Okay, so we get to the 300s, the late 300s, and Jerome translates the Bible into Latin. Again, this is a very high-level, you know, sketchy. There's a lot of other stuff that happened through the course of time. But then what happened was in about 1300, again, you know, 1,000 years later, think about hundreds of years going along, and all the things Ron's talking about happening, different things happen. By this time, the Catholic Church has become the dominant force, not just in religion, but really you hear them talk about the Holy Roman Empire or the Holy Roman Church. The empire and the church had become synonymous, and they were basically ruling, you know, all of that part of the world, and really, for all practical purposes, they were the dominant force in the world. So then along comes a guy named John Wycliffe. I think his first name was John. John Wycliffe, and he did what? He translated the first English version of the Bible. Oh, by the way, one of the questions was, who translated the question 8, who declared the Vulgate to be authentic? The Roman Catholic Church did, and that was done right after Jerome did it, or when? About 1,200 years later, in 1500s, they decided this. We're going to put our okay on this Latin Vulgate. By the way, I think I mentioned last week the Vulgate. The word Vulgate is from the word same word that we get the word vulgar from, which is not vulgar like we think of today, something nasty. It just means common. So it was the Latin of the common man. So that's kind of an important point that I meant to point out. So the Roman Catholic Church at the Council of Trent in 1546 declared the Vulgate to be authentic. And then along came John Wycliffe in the 1500s, I'm sorry, the 1300s, and he translated a Bible into English. It was the first complete English version of the Bible. Okay? Why is that significant? Because what year is it? 1300. Now, the country of England and Great Britain has become very prominent in the world, and English is becoming one of the most common spoken languages. So we go from, you know, Hebrew, and then Greek became more prevalent, and then Latin, and now, you know, 1,000 years later, English is becoming the more prominent language. So somebody said, we need a Bible in our language. So he translated it into English, and then along came men named Tyndale and Coverdale, and they started, you don't want to say mass producing the Bible, but creating the Bible in a printed version of the Bible. So Tyndale gave the Bible the first printed Bible. However, it was only the New Testament, not the whole Bible. How did the Catholic Church feel about all this that was happening? They didn't like it. Why? Because they were in control, and this had become a very politically sensitive situation, and some men were beginning to say, wait a minute, why is it that the Catholic Church gets to tell us everything that we need to believe and that we need to know? Men like Martin Luther, who nailed his famous 95 theses up on the door of the church building and said, you know, this is all not right. We won't go into that. But people were beginning to say, why can't we just read the Bible ourselves? We've got all these copies of it now. Catholic Church didn't like that because that threatened their control. Because were they following the Bible by this time? Now, they had already gone through what we, you know, in believers that believe like I do would say, they had already gone through this great apostasy where they had created a completely separate religion that's contrary or that's very different from the Bible, from what the Bible speaks. Now, what we're trying to do in this church, and what I believe, and what I think most people who are here believe, is what we're trying to do is take this ancient manuscript, I'm sorry, this ancient document, this Bible, and follow just this. You know, we started, Martin Luther came along and said, we need to, the Reformation movement took place, and they said, we need to reform the Catholic Church and fix all these problems in the Catholic Church. There's a lot of pain and conflict that happened as a result of that. And then some people came along and said, we don't really need to reform the Catholic Church because they've already gone away from what was the church in the New Testament. What we need to do is just be that church that exists in the New Testament. And that's what I believe we're trying to do here at North Tampa Church of Christ, is just be that church that existed in the New Testament, because I believe that's what God wants us to be. Okay? So, and then what happened a few years later? Along comes a man named King James, and he authorizes a translation of the Bible to be translated in English. Did we already have some English translations? Yeah, so the King James is not the first English version of the Bible. There were several different ones that had come along. A lot of them were not considered really authentic. The King James is recognized as being an accurate and a good translation because they deliberately went to the point of being very careful in how they translated. They used about 46 different scholars that attempted to translate exactly what the Bible actually said. Okay? So, we come to, question 11. How did, I got a little bit sidetracked there, but the Catholic Church didn't like all of this stuff that was going on, so how did they reward Tyndale for the great work that he did in getting us an English translation? They killed him. They burned him at the stake. Well, what I've read it a couple of different places, is that they actually tied him to the stake, and they tied him to the stake so tightly that he actually died from the choking of being tied, and then they burned his body and scattered his ashes. So the Catholic Church was very brutal during these times. If you ever read any of the history of what was going on, they really had a lot of, you know, brutality in there. They really were just a powerful, you know, entity at that point, and they didn't like all this that was going on. So they punished people that tried to threaten their existence very severely. So, all right. So what then is the Geneva Bible? We talked about the Geneva Bible a little bit. It came along in 1560, and it is significant because it is the first version that divided it into the book, into the Bible, into chapters and verses. It wasn't written, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't sit down and say, okay, chapter 1, verse 1, you know. They just started writing. And for, you know, a couple thousand years, or depending on the Old Testament, a few thousand years, that's how people read the Bible. It was just a solid letter. Paul wrote his epistles just as a letter. The division of the Bible into chapters and verses is, and we've talked about this before, so I won't go deep into it, but it's very convenient for us because it helps us to organize the Bible and memorize certain verses and memorize certain passages that are important to us, because we can refer to, you know, John 3:16, instead of saying, you know, in the book of John, about, you know, a fourth of the way into it, there's this one line, you know, we can say John 3:16. It's very convenient and very good to have that, but that's just a man-made division. So we need to always recognize that. Sometimes those divisions are very fortunate, and there's plenty of examples where a chapter break is not in the best place, because the thought continues in the next chapter, and sometimes we don't recognize that. So, testing? Okay. So the Geneva Bible is the first one that gave us the chapter divisions. So question 13, what is the most popular English version of the Bible? Anybody know? For the most part, the scholars agree that the King James is still, the old King James, not the new King James, is still the most popular version. That might be swapping over a little bit in it, and it may not be that it has the predominance of, it may not be a majority, favorite, but it probably is the most popular as well. There are a lot of people kind of growing up, you know, we thought that's the only Bible. If I'm not using that, if I'm not using the King James, I'm not using the right Bible, you know. And is there anything wrong with the King James Version? What are some negative aspects of the King James Version? Got a hand over here, Leslie. Stacy.
Part of it is because in 1611, a lot of the oldest manuscripts, a lot of the oldest Greek and Hebrew manuscripts had not yet been found. For instance, the Dead Sea Scrolls were not found until 1949.
Right.
And so a lot of that, and Isaiah and Jeremiah, some of the others that were in the Dead Sea Scrolls, were the oldest manuscripts that they had found.
Right.
So a lot of the scholarship was not available. Another thing is, as you've already said, language changes.
Right.
And so a lot of the terminology in the King James doesn't translate, if you will.
Right. Examples would be, the these and the thous, and the, you know, he goeth to the river or whatever. All of the way that the verbs and so forth were worded in that time are just not the way we talk today. Now, you know, I know there are some people that when we pray, they like to still use those these and thous, and there's nothing wrong with that. And they sort of think of that as a little bit more reverent way of referring to that. I think we've mostly moved away from that. But we need to recognize that the language that we read in the old King James, that was just the language of that time, 1611. It was not the way that people spoke in Jesus' time, because they didn't speak English. There was no such thing as English. So that was not the way that they spoke. They didn't necessarily speak in that what sounds like a really reverent language. It's not really necessarily reverent. It's just a different language. Not even necessarily can you say that it's more formal. It's just a different way of speaking the English language. Ron, let's get the mic up here, Ron.
One of the things in my growing up and using the King James, it allowed a lot of commentary by the teachers to express the things that you're expressing now and explain the usage of the words and the difference in the meanings from then to now. And it gave you a bigger, wider picture, if you will, of the meaning of what was being taught at the time. One word that comes to my mind that has really changed is the word awful.
You know,
if we look at something, it's an awful sight. Back then, it meant it. We looked at it in awe. Mm-hmm. Now it's something that's terrible, you know.
Exactly.
It's not good.
It's completely flipped in its meaning. From something that is full of awe to something that is very negative, very bad.
But like I said, if you see words in the old English version, King James Version, that don't mean a lot to you, and you use your commentaries and so forth, that enhances your study and broadens your knowledge, actually, it actually forces you to do that, in my opinion.
Right.
So that's for what it's worth.
Right. And I want to make a comment about the comment made in the back. I really appreciate your good comments back there. And we talked about the language as being a problem, but you were very, very accurate is that when the King James was translated in 1611, we didn't have all of the manuscripts that we have today. So more manuscripts were discovered in the 1800s, and that gave us a little bit better insight into the language. And so in, I believe, 1901, the American Standard Version was created. The last point on the slide here is later versions came along, and we could have expanded on that to a large extent, but I didn't really want to do that. And then, so the American Standard Version came along in 1901, and then, I don't know my dates here, but in the 60s and maybe early 70s when the New American Standard Version came into play. And basically what it did was it took the language and updated it a little bit, Bill.
Yeah, it took the languages of the old American Standard Version and changed it a little bit so it was more popular at the time for people to understand.
Right.
And I think that was like 1960, 63 or something like that.
It's when it was started. I think it was first published in the 70s. And then the King James Version came along, I think, a little bit after that. And it sought to do sort of the same thing with the King James, take some of those these and thous and the goeth and so forth out of that and put it into the more common language. Yes, sir.
Forgive me if I'm getting ahead of you, but it's interesting to note you've got the ASV, the NASV, the ESV. That S is significant. It's standard. Those translations are ones that utilize translators from across different denominational beliefs in an attempt to remove denominational bias from the translation itself. Then you get to others like the New English Bible, which came out in the 60s, which was really nothing more than a paraphrase. You get Eugene Peters' The Message, which is a very good paraphrase, but still a paraphrase.
Right.
If we are looking for a translation that attempts to be very true to the original and to the original intent, that letter S is very, very significant. Kathy and I just moved here from the Nashville area. And one of our good friends is Dr. Rodney Cloud, who is a Hebrew and Greek scholar, but primarily Hebrew, who actually was one of the translators of the ESV. He did a lot of work in the Old Testament, particularly in the book of Isaiah.
Okay, again, thanks so much for your good comments. English Standard Version is one of the ones that has come along very recently that's a very good translation. You know, you may ask, you know, my opinion, what's the best translation? I don't have an opinion of what's the best translation. I know that the NIV, the New International Version, is used very commonly here. It's a version that its purpose was it makes it easier to read. It's a good, easy to read version. I believe there are some concerns about some verses. I won't go into that, you know, in this class, but my point is I think we have to sort of look at a lot of different versions. I tend to read a lot of different versions, and I noticed that Neil uses a lot of different versions when he preaches. He'll put the verse up in whatever version he thinks gets his point across the best at that point. So very good point about the standard. I was not aware of that. That's a great comment about the standard concept of the translators.
But still, isn't a lot of it still the opinion of the people that are writing and interpreting? It's the opinion of those people.
Yeah.
And that now the English Standard Version is supposed to be one of the better ones.
Right.
Okay, that's because of the study and the background and who they had interpret some of the manuscripts and what have you.
Exactly.
So, I mean, I find the English Standard Version is, to me, is easy to read and to understand, especially with all the background information that is provided in that interpretation.
Yep.
But it still gets the man, still is up to the opinion of the people that are putting it together. But now, how do we know today? How do we know today, since we've had the Dead Sea Scrolls and we've had some other scrolls since then, how do we know we have the final?
Yep, that's the $64 million question, is how do we really know? And to some degree, we talked about that last week. To some degree, we just have to have faith that we know that God is going to protect His Word and make sure that we have His Word. I got a couple of slides that give us some examples. I'm not moving, guys, if this will move. There we go. So this is an example of the translation of John 3:16, and we talk about that word-for-word translation. If we tried to translate this up at the top, you see the Greek language. You know, obviously that doesn't really mean a lot. I just thought I'd put that up there to let you see what it looks like. But if we did a word-for-word translation, that second sentence there would be something what it would sound like. Thus for loved God the world, that the Son, the only begotten, He gave so that everyone believing in Him should not perish but should have life eternal. The last part of that makes sense, but the first half of that wouldn't make a lot of sense to us. So then the different translators translated different ways. The one that probably a lot of us in here memorize, the King James, for God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. Now, if you go across those different ones, there's not a lot of difference in those. I don't think there's a lot of conflict in those. Ron.
One of the things when I said in my childhood Bible study classes is the word should in the King James Version. That is dependent upon your conduct in believing in Him. So it makes it dependent.
Right.
The others are more direct and doesn't give the possibility that I'm talking about,
right,
of a failure if you don't.
So there can be a little bit of influence of the translator in there. And the next slide goes into that even a little bit more. This is a translation of Ephesians 2, verses 8 and 9. Again, the Greek up there, which doesn't mean anything. If you translated it literally, it would come out fairly meaningful there. But look at how the King James translates it. For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourself. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. Very prevalent concept in the religious world today that there's absolutely nothing that we do that has anything to do with our salvation. They completely reject the idea of works. And to the point that some people even reject the verse in James as being a valid, legitimate Bible verse that says, not by faith alone, by works are you saved, not by faith alone. Now look at the definition of the word, the Greek word ex, which is translated of. Here it's, let's go to this slide here. It's translated, I don't know if you can see the colors there, but in verse 8, it says, not of yourselves, that's the Greek word ex. Where's my red light? Well, I can't get the red light on here. I keep turning it off. Can we get it back on, guys? Did I turn it off? I've got a red light here somewhere. It's not working. Okay, so let me get back to where I was. Technical difficulties here, guys. Okay. Next, go to the last slide there. Next one. There. Okay, so the word ex, which is in red up at the top, is in verse 8. It says, that not of yourself. They translated it of in the King James, of in the NASB, from in the NIV, and then of your own doing, or not your own doing, in the New Living Translation. That's a paraphrase that was mentioned back there, not a very good translation. But then they translated it of works in verse 9, and then not a result of works, not by works, not a result of works in the other translations. So they're trying to get away from the idea of it being of. The meaning of the word means out of or from or based in. So the meaning of the passage is that our salvation is not based in our works, but it doesn't promote the idea that it's not apart from our works. Yes, we're out of time.
One of the things that we'll find out next week is that the reason some of the apocryphal books were left out and not included in the canon was that it violated what this says. It said salvation was dependent on meritorious works,
yep,
or It was dependent upon how much you paid, the alms that you offered.
That's a whole different study altogether, but that's just an example of how translating can be influenced by the beliefs of the believer or pressure from outside influences. Thank you for your time. I apologize again for going over, but appreciate all the good comments that we had. I'm going to blame it on you for making us go over all the great comments. Thank you, folks.